Yes, so this week what we're doing is the gesture of generosity, the mudra of generosity, which is Varadhar, something like that, was it? Shantasi just told me what that was today. Anyway, so it's the mudra, the gesture of generosity. So we've been looking at these different kind of hand gestures of the Buddha as a symbol of enlightenment. So in Buddhist art all over the world, you know, what you'll see is that these Buddha figures are kind of doing different things. So we have Kuan Yin, mudra of protection. We have the Buddha here with the fearless mudra, which we've done already this time in this series of talks. And he's also giving the gesture, the mudra of generosity. And what these hand gestures are really quite significant, because what they're doing is they're showing in an immediate, visible sense an aspect of the enlightened mind. They are it's like the immediate expression of the enlightened mind. It doesn't just stay in the mind. It actually comes out into the primary physical gestures of the Buddha or of enlightened or beings or bodhisattvas. It comes straight out of their meditation as a gesture, is an action, and it represents the qualities of the enlightened mind, the aspects of the enlightened mind that take action in the world. And a very, very common one, and the last one we're going to look at of these, is the mudra of generosity. And you'll see this, we've got one right here. You'll see it in many archetypal figures in Buddhism, Tara being one of them, and also Ratnasambhava, the Buddha of the South, the mudra of generosity. So we're just going to unpack that a bit tonight. So, well, what does this represent? Why this gesture coming out of the enlightened mind? In a way, the most immediate thing that strikes you about the gesture of generosity, it's expressing, it's the kind of primary expression, in a way, of the vision of the Buddha, the vision of interconnectedness that the Buddha had. The vision of the Buddha, which was beyond separate selfhood. So what the Buddha realized when he was enlightened was that we have a profound effect on each other all the time. There's no sense in which we can lead a separate life, an isolated life from one another. It can't happen. And what he realized was that, in a way, we tend to think of ourselves as, okay, well, on a superficial level we might interact, but there's this hard, isolated core of us, which remains the same whatever happens. Our essential, fixed, unchanging nature, which remains the same whatever interactions we have with others. And actually, the Buddha said, well, that's a delusion. It's not like that. We're profoundly affecting each other all the time, in what we say, in what we do, and even in what we think. And I was going to give you all these sort of traditional examples that you can do, and, you know, these modern examples that are about, you know, well, what does it take to give me a cup of coffee in the morning? But I'm not going to do that. I'm going to say something else. And what I'm going to say is about our practice. That actually one way you can look at interconnectedness, and a very important way for a practicing Buddhist to look at interconnectedness, is to look at our collective element of practice, to look at the collective element of practice. Because we can take this isolated, separate selfhood idea into our own practice by thinking of our own practice as mine. We can think to ourselves that my practice is separate from your practice. So what happens to my practice is I might go to the Buddhist centre and I hear some really interesting and informative things. I might even be quite inspired. And that's good because it affects my practice. And I can go home and I can do my meditation. And, and it might further my practice and my journey towards enlightenment. But I think that we really, really need to look at this view, because actually, there's no such thing as my practice. There's no such thing as my practice in isolation from other people's practice. Just as none of us exist in isolation from others, our practice does not exist in isolation from each other. And our practice is always affecting each other's practice. And it's not like you can just do it on your own. Even, you know, come and get a bit of inspiration from Buddhist Centre and then do it on your own. Actually, my practice is your practice and your practice is my practice. We encourage each other. We inspire each other. And, you know, it's not as if I'm going to kind of walk off home, you know, gain stream entry and possibly enlightenment. And, well, that's jolly nice for me. What a jolly nice experience I'll have. And, you know, you lot can get on with your hindrances or whatever you deal with in your day-to-day life. And, well, you're just never going to be as groovy as me. It doesn't happen like that. Practice is not like that. That's a completely wrong view about how we can practice. And in a way, if I'm going to go on a journey to enlightenment, I have to practice as hard as I can. And one of my practices has to be, I have to be receptive. I have to be receptive to all of you. And it doesn't matter if I've meditated for 100 years and it's all your first Dharma class. Because actually, we do it together. We are the sparks that spark each other off so that we can incandesce. But without each other, it's very, very difficult, if not impossible. So there's two ways in which this is expressed in Buddhism. And the first way is through the bodhicitta. So some of you will have heard this phrase before. The bodhicitta means, bodhi means enlightenment, awakening. And citta is a particular Buddhist word. It means your heart mind. It means the depths of your being. It means what motivates your actions, both emotionally and through your understanding of your of the world. So your heart mind is here. It's not just your intellect. It's just not just your emotional drive, but it's your heart mind. It's the depths of your being. And it's when that depths of your being, your heart of heart, your innermost desire longs for enlightenment. Longs for enlightenment so deeply that the only thing that you can do is move towards that ideal. And the only thing that you can do in this life is do that not just for yourself but for others. That's what the bodhicitta is. It's such longing that nothing can stop it, that nothing can get in the way of your path to enlightenment. And it's collective. They say the bodhicitta is collective. It's not an individual thing that one can gain. We only get it through each other's practice. So why is that? Why is the bodhicitta collective? Well, it is collective because it arises at the point when you transcend the difference between self and other. When there is no separation between self and other, where I cannot see this hard core that's me, that's isolated from you and separate from you. And it's a load of nonsense. It's a load of rubbish to talk about my practice and my bodhicitta and my enlightenment, because actually I am so connected with you that there's no sense in which I can isolate myself and practice for myself. The bodhicitta is an arising of collective practice, an arising of a realization of interconnectedness, profound interconnectedness. And it's often compared to, when this happens, it's a bit like, well, a hand doesn't think twice about pulling a thorn from the foot, because it's all part of one body. So when there's no difference between self and other, when the bodhicitta arises, when my practice is about your practice, there's no sense in which I separate off my practice from you. It's just as if there was a thorn in my foot and my hand was pulling it out. A completely natural action. And that's the supreme generosity in which the Buddha, is demonstrated with the Varada gesture. Whatever. So the other way it's symbolised is the symbol of Indra's net. So Indra's net is said to be made of strings of jewels, made out of nothing but strings of jewels. And each jewel reflects and is reflected by all the other jewels in the net. So it's a bit like all jewels participate in each other's existence but maintain their own identity. So, okay, they're separate jewels, but every single jewel is included in that jewel, and that jewel is included in every other jewel. And, okay, this is slightly my take on it, I have to say. But I kind of reckon it, their sparkle, the fact that they're jewels, their beauty, their incandescence, their sparkle, their joy, in a way, is made up because from the reflections of others. And their reflection in other jewels provides other jewels' beauty, provides other jewels' sparkle. If it was just one jewel on its own, without the reflections of all the other jewels, it would be a pebble, a dull and blank and matte pebble. And that's all it would be. But there's something about the fact that it's all together, that it's reflecting all the other jewels, each jewel is reflecting all the other jewels, that makes it so beautiful and so alive and so sparkling. And without those other jewels, it's a pebble. There's no shine, there's no gloss. And I could probably leave the analogy there. So, you know, the Buddha's coming from that vision when he's talking about generosity. And with that vision, the idea of giving is not some wrench, you know, oh God, not again. I'm going to have to give them something. And, you know, I'm going to be really grown up about this because I'm really spiritual. One, two, three. For the benefit of the little microphone. I won't even try and describe that. Anyway, so, yeah, the whole ideal of Buddhism and generosity is that it's not about a big wrench, you know, and the Buddha's not just some really, you know, well, what a good guy, eh? Actually, it's a delight. It's a delight to give, and it's a very, very natural movement of the enlightened mind. So the Bodhicaryavatara says, I give with no sense of loss. And I often reflect on that. Well, no sense of loss. It's not even a grown-up sense of loss. It's no sense of loss. And there's no sense of loss because giving to others is not a loss from self to others. There's no sense in which it was mine and now I have to give it to you and now I've lost it. It's just a movement. In a funny kind of way, it's a movement, say, from self to self. I'm giving it from my hand to my foot. Well, you know, I'm pretty impartial, actually, about what goes on my hand and what goes on my foot. It's just that my toes are shorter than my fingers, you know. But that's the only qualification I have to take into account. So this is sometimes expressed in Buddhism as the wisdom aspect of Ratnasambhava, who's the archetypal Buddha of generosity. His consort, the female Buddha, the Prajna, or wisdom, is called Mamaki. She's called Mamaki, mind maker. And it's a bit like, in a way, in the vision of the Buddha's enlightenment, everything is his because there's no difference between self and other. So how crazy to think of owning something and giving it to someone else and losing it. How crazy to think of gain and loss because everything's mine. And how crazy to want something so badly that you'd harm another loving, living being to get it. Because everything's mine. How crazy, you know. Everything's mine because no one is separate and nothing is separate from me. So it's a bit like, you know, this movement of, well, it's just a bit like giving something from my hand to my foot. Everything's mine. It's all mine. Which is quite a nice thing to think. You know, sometimes when I get sort of small cravings about things and I had it a while ago, I don't have it anymore, but I had it a while ago about wanting a house. And I remember walking down this street and looking at, and I used to look in people's windows. I wasn't sure I was going to say this, but I will anyway. I'd sort of look in and then, you know, everything would be nice and they'd have kind of, you know, Dulux paint and all the rest of it. And I'm kind of looking and feel really poor and desperate. And then I suddenly remembered Mamaki and I went, well, actually, it's just experience, isn't it? And Just because they own it, it doesn't mean that it's not in my experience. I can enjoy it because everything's mine. It's all my experience. It's like this Buddhist centre is mine because I'm experiencing it and I'm enjoying it. So I think we can really get a real sense of this, you know, that we don't have to, when we can loosen up this distinction between mine and other people's and actually just enjoy things, because we're all part of it. And at the very, very basic level, even beyond below the Buddha's enlightenment, is we're all experiencing things. And we can't separate off experience, saying, well, you know, I'm experiencing Moga Bangsa, but he's his and my and I'm mine. You know, it's just experience, isn't it? So, it's sometimes also called Leela, the play of the Bodhisattva. There's nothing invested in keeping things to myself and clinging on to my things. There's just joy. There's just joy and the pleasure of giving and the pleasure of the receiving and movement from one person to the other. You know, they want it, you give it. How splendid, how wonderful. So this is really exemplified in the Buddha's life. Firstly, it's exemplified in what the Buddha did after he was enlightened. What did he do? Well, he lived as a beggar. He wore robes that were made up of rags. And he spent all of the rest of his life wandering around northern India, teaching anyone who came to him. Even if they came to him with loads of antagonism, trying to catch him out. Even if they hated him. Even if they were those hopeless cases which no one else could deal with. You know, I think that happened quite a lot in the Pali Canon. They'd kind of think, oh my God, let's just send her off to the Buddha. He'll know what to do. Well, the Buddha just spent his life devoted to other people and to helping them realise the vision of the Dharma and helping them fulfil their own potential. There was nothing else in the Buddha's life. There was nothing else cordoned off for some me time. It was all about how to be of benefit to others, how to make his enlightenment experience of benefit to others. Every moment, you know, it's said that even in the night, he would be teaching the devas. The gods would come to him for teachings. I just think that's really inspiring, you know. What does he do with his enlightenment? He shares it. That's the first thing he does. And also he shared his death. He was generous with his death. So in the Parinirvana Sutta, actually the Maha Parinirvana Sutta in the Pali Canon, we get a picture of the Buddha's last days and even his last hours. So to kind of fill you in, the Buddha died. He was 80 years old, a homeless beggar, and he'd been to someone's house and he'd got food poisoning. They'd given him some pig's delight, which some people think is pork, some people think is truffles. So beware pig's delight. Anyway, he got food poisoning off his pig's delight. And he was very, very ill. They said he had sharp pains as if he was about to die and bloody diarrhea. So you would have thought, actually, this is the one time in the Buddha's life where he could actually just say, look, okay, I'm going to die now. So I need a bit of kind of space and, you know, a bit of me time. So, you know, maybe a few people around, but actually, you know, I need to let go of this life. This will be the one time when you'd think, yeah, okay, fair enough. But, well, what were the Buddha's main concerns in his last hour? The first one was that the person, Kunda, who gave him the pig's delight from which he got ill, would feel remorse about that. He was very, very concerned that Kunda wouldn't feel any remorse. So he sent his attendant off to go and speak to him to reassure Kunda that actually it was okay, that the Buddha needed to die, and it wasn't a loss, it wasn't a bad thing. So that was the first thing. The second thing was that, okay, he's got his last hours, his disciples are gathered around him, and up comes an eager young renunciant who has some questions that he wants answered, has some doubts about the spiritual life that he wants answered. Shubhada comes and he says, well, you know, I've got some doubts and I know the Tathagata's dying, so I'd really like to ask him this question before he pops his clogs. No, I don't think that's what I said, but, you know, and you can kind of imagine it. And they were all like,
He's dying.
This is not the time, you know, brother. This is not the time. Could you just ask someone else, you know? But the Buddha, who's lying between the twin sala trees, overhears this and he says, no. This is the time. I can't bring him to me. He has genuine questions about the Dharma, and he's not going to annoy me with those questions. He has genuine questions. You must never refuse a genuine question about the Dharma. So they were all a bit shocked, and then Shubhada comes up and, you know, and he has his questions. And the Buddha reassures him, teaches him about the Noble Eightfold Path. And Shubhada gains, asks for ordination right there and then. So even up until his last moment, the Buddha was concerned that if someone had a genuine question about the Dharma, it must be answered. And then the next thing happens that, he's just about to die, and what does he do? His last question to them all was, does anyone have any doubts? Does anyone have any questions? Because now is the time to ask them, because I'm going to die soon. And this wonderful scene where actually everyone remains silent, and he asks them three times, does anyone have any questions, any doubts? And there were no doubts to be answered. And he said, okay, no doubts. He says, all things are impermanent. With mindfulness, strive on. And he takes that moment to die. And it was so beautiful, because in a way he's checked everything. He's done what he needed to do. There was no doubts left in the Sangha. And he could die at that moment, knowing that what he'd needed to do, he'd needed to share his enlightenment experience. And it was okay. He could die at that moment. So in a way, yeah, generosity is the immediate expression of the enlightened mind. Not as a big heavy duty, but as a natural movement, as a play, as the play of the enlightened mind. And the utmost concern of the enlightened mind being about other people's progression. But we can also look at generosity as a path. So it's called the basic Buddhist virtue, generosity. And I don't know if you've ever come across this, but it's good advice. And the good advice is, if you can't meditate, be ethical. If you can't practice ethics, be generous. Whatever state you are in, you can always practice the Buddhist path, because you can always be generous. Generosity is the foundation of the Buddhist path. If you are generous, you are always on the path of the Buddha. No matter how rubbish your meditations are, no matter how little you've studied, no matter how, you're finding ethics really complicated and you don't really understand what giving up intoxicants means or whatever, anything about that. I was going to say the sexual misconduct one, but that too can be confusing at times. No matter what you can't work out about all those things, be generous, and you are always on the path to enlightenment. However, you can have the best meditations in the whole universe. You can have studied all the Pali Canon, all the Mahayana Sutras. You can have, done all the study you like. You can have got those ethics, down to a really fine understanding. And but if you're not generous, you are not on the path. The generosity is the foundation of the path. And without generosity, you are not on the path to enlightenment. So one must really make sure that the expression of your practice is always generosity. And, it's great to study. It's great to meditate and all those things. But without generosity, they're not the Buddhist path. And, Sangharakshita makes a big thing about this. He says, generosity is the basic Buddhist virtue. It's very apparent in the East, where it's, every time you go and see someone, you always bring a gift. But I'm going to say something new to Sangharakshita. I'm going to say that it's very apparent in Sheffield Buddhist Centre. And it's very apparent in this Buddhist Centre, partly because there wouldn't be a Buddhist Centre without people's generosity. But even from the littlest things to the biggest things, it's generosity that characterizes our Sangha. So I think one of the most delightful things in my life is to watch people leave this class. It's a bit sad, I know, but anyway. I find it really delightful and really, I just think, well, we must be doing something right here if people pick up each other's cushions and take them to the back. And that actually, most of the time, you watch people at the end. They don't just take their cushions back and sod off. Actually, you know, everyone does just a little bit more. You know, they take someone else's. If there's a whole pile of cushions around there, I'll take the other people's cushions for you. And I just find that, well, that's the expression of the enlightened mind in action, in a funny kind of way. That's the path. That's no selfhood in action. That's interconnectedness in action. And even on the big things, I know Frank and I were looking at the library a bit today, and, well, he's been looking at it, and I popped in and took the glory. And we were just remarking, weren't we, on the amazing quality of books we've got in there. You know, people just keep on leaving these really expensive, really wonderful Dharma books. You know, the Sheffield Buddhist Centre has not bought any books for that library. They've all been donated. And they're all really good books as well, you know. So from the littlest to the biggest things, I think generosity is the cement that holds our sangha together. Yeah, right, okay. Yeah, good. Yeah. And it's really important to be generous. It is the path, because generosity is one of those things that gets right to the heart of the wheel of life. So we've been talking about the wheel of life in this series of talks, and we've seen that the hub of the wheel of life is greed, hatred and delusion, and that keeps the wheel of samsara, the wheel of kind of mundane life, revolving. Greed, hatred and delusion. The whole set of problems comes from these three poisons right at the root, the hub of the wheel of life. And it's generosity that can put its hand in and stop it right at the root. It's generosity that is the virtue that covers all three, greed, hatred and delusion. It covers greed because it enables you to have a healthy attitude at possessions. It enables you to have a healthy attitude towards the external things which we use to bolster up our identity. So what happens is that we think a lot of the time that, if I have a really nice car, if I have a really nice house, if I have like loads of mince pies, and if I'm a size 10 and I have a really nice boyfriend, and blah, 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 if I go on retreat in the Himalayas and eat quinoa or whatever it's called for 2 weeks, then I'll become enlightened. And it looks at all this scenario, right? And, that's what we think is going to make us happy. But in a way, what generosity does is it shows us that if you let go of those ideas, if you just give those things away, well, that's what makes you happy. And the more you give, in a funny kind of way, the less you realise you need. The less you need, the more you... because in a way you realise it's not those externals that are going to bolster up your identity. It's not those externals that are going to make you happy. And it loosens up your whole attitude towards your possessions. You see that by giving, you're okay. You know, that you have this whole scenario. What's going to happen if I don't have this particular possession? And you realise actually it's okay. It's actually the pleasure of giving to someone else is much more than clinging on to these possessions so that they're mine and this is me. I'm the kind of person that has, I don't know, the entire set of the Star Wars figures from the 1979 edition of blah blah. Don't know where that came from. Yeah, you realise that actually loosening your hold is what makes you happy. And that you don't need all these things to bolster your identity. So the second thing, the second poison is hatred. And of course, generosity is the most basic expression of loving kindness, of metta, of goodwill. And sometimes the practice of generosity, what it can make us do, is that if you can try it, be a bit generous as much as you can to someone you don't like. And what it does is it just loosens up that kind of tight fist of hatred And you remember something. You remember, after you give them something, you remember something. And what you remember is your humanity and their humanity. And you remember the fact that they need other people just as you need other people. That actually none of us can live in isolation. And the fact that we're here is not a coincidence. It's a whole culmination of relationships and other people's kindness right from the moment that you were born, if not before, actually. You've relied on other people's kindnesses to be who you are. And you realise that in that act of kindness, that generous action towards someone, that they need it and that you are providing, you are of benefit to them. And you remember that actually, beyond all hatred, beyond all our funny difficulties with each other, what we want is to be connected. And what we want is to be of service to others. And by being of service to others, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter about all those petty concerns. Because actually we need each other all the time. And people you don't like need you just as much as people that you do like. We need each other. We can't afford to run along these lines of separation and hatred if we want to live a happy, healthy life, if we want to progress. So it loosens this idea of hatred. It loosens this tight fist of I'm separate from you and you've done me wrong, and opens you out to a kind of humanity, a human vision of what we all need. And the third poison is delusion. So, I mean, in a way, well, we've been talking about this, but it breaks through this story about the world that says, well, I'm separate from you, and I need this, otherwise I won't be happy. And if I give this to you, it's going to be a loss for me, it's going to be impoverishment for me. And it undermines you, undermines those kind of stories and those kind of views, because what you're doing is you're acting out the fact that you're interconnected. And the more that you act out your interconnectedness, the more you'll realise your interconnectedness. The more you'll realise that the richest man that has ever lived on this earth has been the Buddha. And he was a beggar, and he lived in rags, and he slept in ditches, and he only owned a robe and a bowl. And actually, why was he so rich? He was so rich because he was so connected to others that he lived out his connectedness. So it undermines this delusion that we've got. It's a practical way of undermining delusion, undermining these stories that we have about the world, which says that we're separate and isolated from others. So, well, anyway, okay, so generosity is the path and it's the goal. But how do we practice it? How do we practice it? So, well, one of the things is to follow through generous impulses. A lot of the time, you know, we have this idea, oh, I'd really like to send them a card, or I should give this to them. And then what do? We it's a bit like the planning department come in and they say, well, I don't know, I mean, because, you know, if you give that away, if you write a postcard, you know, on the timeline, it's not quite fitting in with the thing. And then, you know, they bring out the big ruler and then they say, no, it's impossible, I can't do that. Or you just kind of forget about it, you know. Oh, they'll just think I'm a hippie. You know, there's the other planning side of the planning department, the hippie busters. Now just think, you're a tree hugger. You're turning into a Buddhist tree hugger. You're a bit of a fruitcake, a bit of a Buddhist fruitcake. And so you think, well, maybe not today. Well, let's all be Buddhist fruitcakes, tree huggers, dirt munchers, whatever we want to call ourselves. Follow them through. A generous impulse is a gift. And as much as we're able, we should follow them through every time. But if you don't have any generous impulses, which sometimes can be the case, you can make up little precepts. You can make up little precepts. You can start with small precepts. Like some people do this thing, give something away every day. Well, that's good. You can start small. You can start with, you know, a pencil or... I don't know. Steal someone's flowers from their garden? No, don't do that. Start small and build it up. Take a precept up about giving something away. Give something away every week even. But yeah, definitely follow through any generous impulses. So So it's a bit like generosity has to start off at the level of that you're ready and let it grow. But watch out about this planning department. You know, the planning department comes in so much of our positive impulses and criticises us and measures and weighs and says, well, you know. Just let that go for a bit and just see where it takes you, just following through generous impulses. But it also leaves the question of, well, what can we give? What can we give? So the first thing, and many of you will have heard this list before, it's a traditional list. But traditional basically means it's in the Buddhist tradition somewhere, but I can't remember where it is. Just in case you know. Material things. So the first thing is material things, things like money. And at the time of the Buddha and throughout the Buddhist history of the Buddhist Sangha, there's always been a symbiotic relationship between lay people and sort of full-timers in whatever capacity those full-timers are. And what needs to happen is that we need some people to earn money and get material things so that full-timers can practice. But that lay people who are earning that money need the full-timers to give them a kickstart in their practice, to show them what can be done with their practice. So there's always been this relationship between the two that's absolutely essential to the Buddhist Sangha. And without one of them, the other half would die. Without the lay people bringing in wealth and material possessions, there'd be no full-timers, because what would we live on? But at the same time, without the full-timers, it would be very hard for those lay people to keep their practice going, to gain enough inspiration and reflection to keep their practice going. So we all need material things. It's the same today for our current Sangha. Without people giving standing orders, how will we pay the electricity bill? We can't pay the electricity bill in Dharma classes. I'm sure, you know, British Gas and whatever, Yorkshire Electricity, wouldn't be too chuffed if we wrote to them and said, I'm sorry, we don't have any money. But what we can do is we can teach you meditation. Could give it a go, but I don't think they're really going to be that up for it. So we need material things. We need material things for the Sangha to operate. But, you know, not everyone's in a position to give material things. Not everyone's got a lot of money. And I don't know if this is a common thing, but my mum always used to say to me, well, you've either got time or money, but never both. I've got neither time nor money, but I don't know what's happening there. Anyway, time and energy. So we might not always be in a position to give material goods or money, but we can be in a position to offer time and energy to put into other people, time and energy to put into the Buddhist Centre, time and energy to put into each other, you know. So I'm not going to say much more about that. The third one is knowledge and expertise. So this was quite a big thing, actually, at the Buddha's time, the time of the Buddha, because traditionally, a lot of knowledge, particularly religious knowledge and writing, was kept to certain castes, certain social economic positions. So you could only, and that was, you know, dictated by birth. So you could only really learn to write, read and write, if you were in the Brahmin caste. You could only learn about religious matters if you were in the Brahmin caste. And it was very secretive. So a lot of the Buddha's thing was, well, we mustn't keep knowledge to ourselves. How will the world progress if what we know, what expertise we know, we keep to ourselves and guard as a secret? We'll just die out. So he made a big thing about giving knowledge and expertise. And the fourth thing is merit. So in this context, we could look at merit as the merit we accrue from our virtuous actions. So what it's saying is, to give away your merit means that we become happy, healthy human beings. We develop our qualities, not to keep to ourselves so that we're really groovy or really cool or whatever, but actually to enable us to be of real help to other people. You know, the more generosity that I cultivate is not about my benefit, it's also about your benefit. It's about, creating, undertaking Buddhist practice, but also just generally becoming happy, healthy human beings so that we can be of benefit to others. Because if we're not happy, healthy human beings, then what good do we do to people? We're just going to take up energy. So we need to get ourselves sorted. We need to develop our qualities in order to be of benefit to others. So the next one is life and limb. What is she going to ask me to do next? So it might seem a bit excessive, but there's two ways you can look at this. And one of them is that actually for some people we'd be quite willing to give up life and limb. And if we could give it up for someone, well, maybe you could have a reflection. If I could give it up to them, could I, extend that? Could I give it up for others? It's just an interesting reflection to have. But I also think there's something else. And I think that the other thing is that often we risk our health, we risk our bodily well-being for a higher interest, for something bigger in a way. So one of the things that I'm sure Ginny would be able to tell you about is climbing. Well, climbing seems to me an exceedingly dangerous thing to do with one's life and limb. In a way, you're prepared to put yourself at that risk for a higher objective, because I don't know really why people climb, but I'm sure there's lots of reasons, for pleasure and for the challenge and to feel invigorated and to reach a very big cliff, good thing. So we're prepared to do it for things like climbing, but we're prepared to do it every day. We're prepared to go into a plane, to get into a car. I'm sure all of us will know someone who's had a car accident. So we're prepared to risk life and limb to get to work every day. So in a way, why shouldn't we be prepared to risk life and limb in a way for the Dharma? And I often think this about vegetarianism. I think that I made a decision then when I became a vegetarian that actually it might not be as good for my health as eating meat. I don't think it's particularly bad for your health, but it might not be as good as eating meat. And I'm prepared to do that as an act of generosity towards other living beings. That actually I'm prepared to take that risk in order not to kill another living being. So I think, we do take a big risk with our life and limb just existing. So getting out of bed in the morning. So in a way, well, why not do that for our higher ideals? And for each other as well. If we can do it to get to work in the morning, could we do it for each other? So the other thing is the Dharma. And for the Buddhist tradition, well, this is the most important thing. But I think we can look at the Dharma in quite a broad sense. The Dharma is about helping people achieve their potential. It's about helping people to live from their depths. It's about helping people become who they really could be, fulfill their deep potential. It's about helping people develop wisdom and compassion and energy. In a way, that's not just about standing up here teaching. It's providing the conditions in which people can do this. So I think, if we're thinking about Sheffield Buddhist Centre, we've all contributed to the Dharma by enabling the existence of Sheffield Buddhist Centre. And that takes all of the above. It takes material things. It takes people bringing baked beans to the potato club, for example. It takes standing orders. It takes money. It takes time and energy. There's a lot of people who've devoted a lot of time to this Buddhist centre, the gardening team, people coming in to clean. That's a lot of time, a lot of energy, even quite physical energy, without which we wouldn't have a Buddhist centre, or certainly not as lovely Buddhist centre as we do have. It's taken a lot of knowledge and expertise. There's some people who are who say, for example, we've got Ian and Mark on the finances and Leslie helping with, admin and finances. And in a way, it takes their expertise that we need to draw on. I don't know anything about finances. Rubbish. All that kind of accounting stuff. I haven't a clue. So we need everyone's expertise in order to run this Buddhist centre. We need people to become bigger, happy, healthy human beings, to be For example, just with basic friendliness. We need people to come here and be friendly to people. For example, the Buddha beginner's course, which is coming here next week. We need to be really, really friendly to the to the people who are coming here next week, because in a way they're going to be that you're there. You might be the kind of the only Buddhist they know. You know, sometimes you can find yourself in a position where you're the first Buddhist that anyone has ever met. So to create the conditions for the Dharma, we need to be friendly to people. We need to be, in quite a good state to be able to be a positive benefit to others. We need to sacrifice our life and limb. I didn't think through this. Well, you never know what walking around this Buddhist centre, what health and safety issues there might be. Puja can be tricky business. So we need all these things to enable the Dharma to be available to people in Sheffield. And people use that, they draw on the Dharma. But in a way, it's more than that, because I began this talk about talking about the bodhicitta. And it's all of our generosity by sharing our practice that enables the bodhicitta to arise. Now, this is a real possibility that the bodhicitta could arise in Sheffield. That's what my life is about. Is about creating the conditions for the bodhicitta to arise in Sheffield. And I can't do that alone. What we all need is to be sharing our practice, to sharing our inspiration, and creating the conditions for something much bigger than the sum of its parts to arise. That's, in a way, our main gifts. It's a bit like, well, what would the Sheffield Buddhist Centre be without people here benefiting from it and sharing their practice together? It will be me standing in an empty hall. Well, I can give as much as I like and live whatever life I can, but if there's no one going to listen to me, then, well, it's all a bit fruitless, really, isn't it? So the main thing about giving the Dharma, I think, is to share our practice, to be generous with our practice, to practice hard, not just for ourselves, but for others, and to create the conditions for the bodhicitta to arise.